Goodbye, Dr. Banda. Lessons for the West from a small African country. You may never have been, may never go, may never have even heard of the place, but Malawi will repay your attention. It's one of the smallest, poorest countries in Africa, often overlooked, but its relationship with us in the West has been extraordinary. It is the new book by Alexander Chula. Delighted to be saying Alexander joins me live on the line now. Good morning to you, Alexander.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
The pleasure is all mine. For those of us who have absolutely no idea where we are, what we're talking about, describe to us a little bit about where actually Malawi is and a little bit about its background.
So Malawi is a small, obscure, impoverished country in southern Central Africa. It borders Zambia, Mozambique and Tanzania. It was formerly part of the British Empire, got its independence in 1964, became a protectorate in 1891. And it is indeed a country that many people know very little about. But that's rather the premise of my book, which is to try to look at contemporary Western concerns from a very different, hopefully a fresh perspective.
Because you know, the story of Africa is, to a large extent, still one of the dark continent. We kind of, the only time Africa ever makes our new news feeds and our news reports is when normally something sort of terrible is happening, and so there's a great ignorance amongst many Europeans about what actually is the heartbeat of Africa.
Yeah, I think that's very true, and even for Malawi, which might be one of the marginally better known countries of the region, because it does have a small tourist industry. It's known as the warm heart of Africa. It's seen as a sort of Africa for beginners is how the tourist board have marketed it. But despite that, I think you're absolutely right. It comes to prominence mainly when some sort of blight, dearth, famine, or other natural disaster strikes, you know, as recently with Cyclone Freddy. That's part of the reason why Malawi is so well known, is because it's a focus for so much international aid effort. So a lot of that gets directed to Malawi. I think that's because of a combination of things. One, it's got all of the problems which international aid organizations try to alleviate, but also because it is actually a very pleasant and relatively safe country to live in as a Westerner.
And what was your relationship with Malawi, and how did you find yourself there?
So very much by accident. So I'm a medical doctor. I work in infectious diseases, but before I became a doctor, I'd studied classics, so Latin and Greek, Greco-Roman civilization. And I was looking for jobs in Africa before I applied for medicine. I imagined that I might be working with one of the aid organizations that I've just mentioned. But then I saw a job advertising for a teacher of Latin and Greek in Malawi, and thought it was probably the only job on the entire continent I was actually qualified to do. So I applied for that, and yes, found myself in Malawi, a country with which I had no connection whatsoever before going to teach Latin and Greek there.
First impressions? I mean, it's an awfully long way, I suppose, from going to the dreamy spas of Oxford to an unknown country.
Yes, indeed. The contrast could not have been more stark. My first impressions, it was surreal. It looks, as a landscape, like every sort of cliche, tourist brochure cliche of splendid Africa, you know, glorious plains and sunsets and so on, but also with all of the very, very prominent hardship and poverty which is there all around you. And yes, I wasn't working in the capital either. I was picked up from the airport and taken to a properly remote part of the country that was 150 miles away from the capital, in a properly rural setting. But within this rural setting, there was this extraordinary school modeled on Eton College, known in fact as the Eton of Africa. which had been created in the 1980s with the specific purpose of promoting Latin and Greek in Africa.
And was it here that you stumbled on? Is it a copy? It's an extraordinary find, I think, or an unexpected find.
Are you referring to the
Gallic War?
Yes. Okay. So I sort of start the book with this episode where I'm exploring a ruined palace that was sort of 30 miles or so from the school. And I was there actually to try to catalogue whatever remained of the palace library. The palace itself was deserted, in disarray. There were sort of baboons scampering through it, one elderly caretaker, but otherwise nobody there at all. And most of it in a state of dereliction. But there was one portion of the palace complex that was just about preserved, and that was the library with an associated strong room. That itself was, you know, encrusted with cobwebs. There were sort of, yeah, insects eating away at the silk wallpaper. There was a wild bees nesting in the corner. But inside, I found this chest, and there wasn't any light, so I had to take it outside to examine the contents. But it did look properly like a sort of old fashioned treasure chest from a pirate movie. And inside I found this 1584 edition of Caesar's Gallic Wars, which had been printed by Aldus Manutius, which is the most celebrated press of the Renaissance, or one of the most celebrated presses of the Renaissance. So a priceless work of classical history that was sitting in a decaying palace on the side of an African mountain. And so I suppose how it got there is the question that introduces my book.
I mean, that was going to be my next question. How on earth did that end up there? And what was your initial reaction must have been to sort of, I don't know, sort of scratch your head and make sure you hadn't had something stronger than the local brew that morning.
Indeed. And the temptation to rescue it, I have to confess, was very strong indeed. I was hoping that I might find something of the sort. But what I actually found far exceeded my expectations. And the reason I was half hoping for something like that was because of my awareness of the extraordinary figure of Dr. Banda, to whom the palace had once belonged.
The book is called Goodbye, Dr. Banda. So the next question, obviously, is who was Dr. Banda?
Yeah, so... something to emphasize, first of all, this is not a biography of Dr. Banda, but it's just the case that this extraordinary character's life provides a useful framework for the narrative of the book, which is itself a mix of history, memoir, travelogue, and a little bit of biography. So Banda is Malawi's first president after independence, and he rules the country for 30 years well into his 90s. Conveniently, his life spans pretty much exactly the entire course of the 20th century. And he has, he's remarkable for a number of reasons. I mean, the first is how extraordinarily varied his life experience is. He is born to a letterless Malawian peasant family in the 1890s, in a tribe that's only just started to experience European contact. He gets some very basic lessons from Scottish missionaries, but obviously is stirred by the idea of a higher vision of education, which has started to percolate into the country through other missionaries. So he sets off on foot to South Africa, walks 1,000 miles in the hope of getting an education, ends up working in the mines there for a few years, but is studying on the side as he does so. Then gets a scholarship to America on the basis of how well he's doing in his private study. Goes there and studies classics, liberal arts, anthropology, literature. Then makes a switch to medicine. Qualifies as a doctor. Comes then to the UK. Studies further in Scotland, in Edinburgh, practices as a doctor there. So he has a full career as a medical doctor in Britain, which goes through the period of the Second World War. And then afterwards, in the post-war period, as the winds of change are spreading through Africa, he becomes involved in anti-colonial politics and becomes fairly quickly identified as the most qualified and competent person to run Malawi, which is approaching independence. And so his next career as president of Malawi begins already in his 60s, and he is the dominant political figure in Malawi, for the second half of the 20th century.
And it's a fascinating period because you've got that end of colonialism, and also the huge cry for independence and the granting of independence in the 40s and 50s and 60s with former colonies, basically.
Yeah, no, very much so. But what's curious about Banda is his sort of ambiguous attitude towards the West. So at the same time, he is a triumphant anti-colonial hero, worshipped, by his people, celebrated by African leaders for that. In particular, he's the key figure in opposing the Federation of Central Africa, which is an attempt to kind of create a new white-ruled state consisting of Zambia, Zimbabwe, and Malawi, previously Nyasaland. But on the other hand, he has become obsessed with Western high culture during his time in America and Britain. And what, for me, the focus of my interest in Banda is his curious attempt to integrate the best of Western and African cultures. And he has a very sort of idiosyncratic, very individualistic vision of how to do that.
The thing is, of course, that if you try and impose one set of values on a new and an evolving nation, perhaps it doesn't always work. And there's always a saying, this is Africa, i.e. things are done differently here.
Yes, that's true. And I think certainly you can, you can assess. So, I mean, Banda's project in his later years was to try to sort of recreate Greco-Roman civilization in Africa, which is, yes, in many ways can be seen as a ludicrous project. And as you say, very seldom work out the way as planned, especially perhaps in Africa. But I think the curious thing about Banda's experiment is the law of unintended consequences. And I think his experiment has resulted in a genuine meeting of worlds between the two cultures, between the high culture of the West, especially classical culture, and local African culture.
I was going to say, because this is one of the things that we are getting more and more aware of, the huge variety of cultures in Africa and the return of cultural artifacts. Obviously, I'm thinking about Benin, for example, in Nigeria. And was he able to pull off that trick then of imposing, as you said before, Roman Greco culture, as well as recognizing and bringing to the light perhaps the culture of the native culture, as it were.
Yeah, so I mean, I think on the latter point, Banda is unusual because almost all African dictators like to pay lip service to celebrating their local culture. Banda, to my mind, really did actually promote it. He was interested in it as a former student of anthropology. He was interested in how to curate it, how to celebrate it. He genuinely devolved power to local traditional sources of authority, which for an African dictator is unusual, and certainly not a feature of those of his peers who were, as I said, paying lip service to the idea of local culture. That's on the African cultural side. On the Western cultural side, which you started with, I think Banda's experiment really has to be seen as in the context of a broader obsession with high culture and a context of remarkable intellectual curiosity, which was seeded in the late 19th century by British missionaries, especially Scottish missionaries, and which has permeated Malawian history ever since. There's one figure that I consider that illustrates this particularly well. He's a Scottish missionary called Robert Laws, who operates in northern Malawi at a time amongst tribes that are have no experience of writing when he arrives, and yet within his lifetime he establishes this academic institution of extraordinary ambition, which within his lifetime has got his students learning Latin, Greek, and Hebrew. And that sort of then, I mean, Banda is certainly aware of that, and because of that sets himself this very high academic ambition. But it also feeds into the whole culture of Malawi, which has its own literary tradition, which is very strong and very remarkable for a country of such a small size.
And yet, he did. If he's trying to establish a Roman tradition, he becomes a tyrant, a dictator. He becomes a Caesar, if you will.
Banda is an extremely ambiguous figure, and in fact, as I show in the book, Malawi does a good line in ambiguous figures. Yes, he was a brutal tyrant. He was a dictator, but he was a man of many parts, and I think his legacy is one that is going to be hotly contested within Malawi for some time to come. Even now, he is a divisive figure, but it's by no means the case that that everybody denounces him now and reviles him as a tyrant and nothing more.
And his influence, it has this huge this influence is huge on the country itself, and the mix of peoples. You described this cast of characters that include pop stars, hippies wandering through, and again, as I think it says, the peasants who always seem to get, who always seem to be the ones who suffer most, grumbling or just going, the peasant's lot is never a happy lot.
Yes, so Malawi has sort of been the like a stage set for this very bizarre array of characters, and that's the focus of the core part of my book, is to try and give an account of how Westerners have engaged with the local culture in Malawi, from the period of Livingstone and the early missionaries up to the present day, with pop stars, you like allude to Madonna. Contemporary tourists, aid workers, and I'm trying to really look at how we as Westerners have engaged well and badly with that local culture by doing a compare and contrast, if you like, of these very, very different approaches. But yes, Malawi has indeed experienced, I suppose, the full gamut of different types of Westerner trying to engage with this culture.
And if you like, is this a snapshot then about how Westerners engage with Africa, how Africans engage with the world, and indeed how people of African descent in various parts of the world, or African heritage, how they look at themselves and how they identify themselves?
So it's definitely the first of those. Not so much the latter. I mean, the focus is narrow because I wouldn't particularly presume to try to assess how Africans in Africa or elsewhere how they regard themselves. My book is focused on Westerners, and as you say, it's about how Westerners engage, and in particular struggle to engage, with cultures that are wildly, wildly different from their own. And obviously, the context is an African one, but I think some of the problems that I consider are more general. I mean, I've said in the past to my publisher and so on, my experience happened to be in Malawi, but I think I could have written a similar book had I been living in Southeast Asia or Latin America. I think there are sort of common trends in the way that Westerners struggle to engage with cultures that are completely different from their own.
And that perhaps is a sense of what cultural superiority, cultural imperialism, and just a, if you like, a basic lack of understanding, or, and here comes a word from the 21st century, an empathy with other cultures?
I think there's certainly a failure of empathy. I don't spell this out explicitly in the book. I sort of leave it for readers to make their own mind up. But what I suppose I'm inclined to suspect myself is that Westerners cannot hope to understand why other people's cultures are so important to them when so many in the West have no real grasp of their own culture, when the meaning of their own culture is so mysterious and opaque to them. How can they reach out and explore another? And that goes into your, ties in with your empathy comment. So the local culture of Malawi is one that's arisen in response to extremity of circumstances, to life that seems everywhere precarious, to a sort of omnipresent threat of hardship, physical suffering, death. And it's confronted with a Western culture that is deeply materialistic, concerned with pursuit of comfort, safety, pleasure. And these two collide in a country like Malawi. Yes.
What do you hope the people take from your book, Goodbye, Mr. Banda?
So that, I suppose, is the main lesson that I want to impart, is that if we don't have a grasp on our own culture, then we can't really hope to explore another's, and we can't understand why another people would, why another people's culture would be so important to them. And so I suppose it's looking at the approaches of different Westerners and looking at how actually some of our forebears did get this right. And I'm thinking in particular of some of the missionary anthropologists that I describe, who were deeply rooted, deeply acquainted in their own culture, and yet reached out to the local culture in a way that was serious, that was mutually uplifting. There are missionaries that are basically responsible for recording what we know of so much of Malawi's early history. And it's because of their, you know, very empathetic study of the local cultures, that we have that record.
The book is called Goodbye, Dr. Banda, Lessons from the Westerns for the West from a Small African Country. It's by Alexander Chula, who's been speaking to you today. Alexander, if people want to find you online, is there a website? Is there social media? Where can people find you?
So there is a website, alexanderchula.com, which is also a Twitter handle. And the book is published by Polygon, which is an imprint of Berlin, and that's released tomorrow, in fact.
Well, congratulations on the book. The book is called Goodbye, Dr. Banda. It's by Alexander Chula. Alexander, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks very much for having me on the show.